Hello and welcome to another TribCast from the Texas Tribune. I'm Ben Philpott, reporter for the Tribune and KUT News, here with Evan Smith, CEO and editor-in-chief of the Tribune.
My Elise, your voice is much lower this week.
Ross Ramsey, managing editor.
Howdy.
And Matt Stiles, reporter here at the Tribune, and strangely enough, Elise's husband.
Hello.
Is he substituting for you or substituting for Elise?
I think probably, well, if we're lucky, he'll fill in where I start to mess up. So for both of us.
Three, two, one.
There you go. So today we're going to talk about, well, the biggest news in Texas really from the past week was the Obama visit, President Obama coming to town. Also, the Doggett Amendment. There was a contentious battle up in D.C. yesterday for a bill that should bring some money to the state for education, but had a little amendment that people didn't like. Bill White and his donor appointees also residency issues in the state. So let's start with the big issue of the week. Evan, President Obama came to town.
You wouldn't have known that anything else was going on, and then all of a sudden he was gone and the rest of the news showed up in our papers. But for a while there, it was all Obama all the time. And it was the run-up to Obama being here. It was Obama being here. It was, well, what's the impact of Obama being here? And much of the coverage in the Tribune, Ross, your great story, and elsewhere, was about who was unwilling to be with Obama. There were an awful lot of people lining up to get tickets to see the president at the University of Texas or to be part of the fundraiser at the Four Seasons or at Russell Budd's house in Dallas. But two people who did not want to be
playing hide and seek
in the room with the president were Bill White and Chet Edwards. They were two of the more high-profile Democrats unwilling to be seen with the president. They, of course, dispute that there's anything going on here, nothing to see, keep walking. I always planned to be in Alvarado campaigning, says the White campaign. And there was a lot of discussion about whether this was a plus or a minus for the governor to be White, the gubernatorial candidate, and for Congressman Edwards. But the reality is, it seems to have come and gone without too much impact on either one. White is now almost being seen as having Jim Henson's post on the Tribune on Monday kind of got at some of this. Mm-hmm. White is almost seen as having been politically savvy, avoiding a guy whose numbers were lower in Texas than his.
Right.
And the impact on him with his base doesn't seem to have been too significant, at least anecdotally. No one seems to be complaining that White blew it with the Democrats. And in Edwards' case, Edwards' failure to appear with Obama was overshadowed that afternoon by the NRA Victory Fund's endorsement of him in a race against
Bill Flores. And no mistake. I mean, Edwards knows what he's doing.
The timing of the endorsement was clearly meant to salve any wounds.
You know, the Texas Farm Bureau is based in Waco, which is convenient.
And the Ag Fund, which is their political arm,
their Political Action Committee, endorsed Edwards. And the surprise here was, everybody in Waco goes to this press conference. Chet Edwards announces he's going to get the endorsement of the Ag Fund. Big whoop, he always does. And the surprise was, and I have the endorsement of the NRA's Political Action Committee. Now, the NRA does two things. They rate politicians, they give them basically like a report card. Right. And Edwards had an A rating. Bill Flores, his opponent, the Republican, also has an A rating. The extra little something here was that they said that our PAC is going to contribute to and support Edwards. So
only three Democrats in the country, including Edwards, have gotten the NRA Victory Fund's endorsement. It's a close race. Both Flores and Edwards have a lot of money.
It counts. And it's Republican. And as you say, it's a generally Republican, not always, but it's a generally Republican PAC. It's cover for a Democrat who's running. We've said this a million times, but this is the most Republican district in the United States that's represented in Congress by a Democrat. And he's defended it successfully. I guess this is the 10th. He's seeking a 10th term or seeking an 11th term.
Yeah.
So he got some cover on this. I think both he and White were doing the same thing. They know Democrats are going to vote for them. They know that Republicans are not going to vote for them, and they have to fight for independents to win. And Obama's not popular with independents right now, and the association doesn't help them. So, whenever you look at an appearance or anything like this, you're looking at whether this association is additive or subtractive. And right now, in those districts, in this state, for those guys, Obama was subtractive.
Matt, you think that's a good thing for White to have not been with the president?
Oh, I'll let him explain whether it's a good thing for him or not. I sort of wonder whether a lot of this is just a creation of the media and how much it actually matters. I don't know.
Oh, I'm certain it's a creation of the media.
it's a creation of the opponent.
We create things. That's what we do.
Well, it is. The media certainly adds gasoline to it, but it's a creation of the opposing campaigns. Perry really wanted White on stage with Obama. Flores really wanted. In fact, Flores offered to pay the costs. Right. This was actually pretty funny. Flores offered to pay the reasonable costs of a town hall meeting with Obama and Chet Edwards. I want to see you guys together so much, I'll pay for it. So that's where the spark comes from. The gasoline comes from the press.
And you had the spectacle of the governor trotting out to the airport to meet the president to hand him that letter on border security.
Right.
And, you know, somebody commented on Twitter after we posted our stuff about what happened on Monday, you know, the governor wants the president to secure the border. They can't even secure the tarmac at Bergstrom Airport. How'd they all get out there? It was a spectacle. But, you know, in the end, Matt is kind of the Mr. Campaign Finance numbers cruncher. You know, the fundraiser at the Four Seasons netted $1 million, which is a lot of money.
Yeah, I saw somewhere the two fundraisers netted 1.6.
Yeah, and I wonder, as you know, as Obama crosses the country and goes from state to state, if political reporters in each of these states have to go through the same spectacle where, you know, everyone distances themselves from Obama and it's a couple day story and the Republican candidates jump on. I wonder if this is, you know, an awkward thing for Obama in every state he goes to.
Well, it happened in Georgia. We talked about this on the podcast previously, but then Ross pointed out to me on Monday that actually Patty Murray running for reelection in a race. She's not this isn't a walk. This is a real race against Dino Rossi, who ran for governor several years ago against the incumbent governor. It's a couple point race, probably. Murray's in the lead, but it's a tough race. She's asking for the president to come campaign for. President came and campaigned for Barbara Boxer.
Right.
You know, at her invitation in California. It's not as if he's toxic every place.
The Democratic primary in Colorado that ended yesterday, I can't remember the candidate names.
Michael Bennett is the incumbent appointee after Salazar left.
Right.
Bennett was an Obama guy.
Obama guy. The challenger was a Bill Clinton guy.
Romanoff, who's the House Speaker
Former House
Speaker in Colorado, was a Clinton guy. Bennett didn't just beat Romanoff. Bennett creamed Romanoff.
So it may be that these people reevaluate the numbers. And, you know, I got to say, this happened to Bush. This happened to Clinton. This happened to Bush. This happened to Reagan. This is always the case.
You become toxic at a certain point.
Is the president a good association or a bad association for candidate X in state X? And, you know, it varies by state.
Well, I wanted to throw out real quickly somebody who did show up to the to the president's event.
Tony Sanchez.
Well, I didn't see Tony Sanchez, but I did see now you're going to throw names out and I'm going to forget all my names. I did see Representative Dan Branch from Highland Park there in Gregory Gym at the event. Now, that makes sense. He's the chair of Higher Education Committee in the Texas House.
The chairman was there, I suspect. Not the state rep, the chairman.
Right. But what, you know, in this political environment we're in, what people would say doesn't make sense is a Republican showing up to anything that Barack Obama is talking about.
Well, a Republican from who lives within, you know, walking distance of George W. Bush's house, was pretty high up in George W. Bush's finance organization in both of his presidential runs. I mean, this is
who was a lawyer volunteering on the 2000 Florida recount effort. And Branch
his bona fides are pretty good.
He's a Bush guy, but you know, Branch is also, if you recall, Branch was briefly going to run for attorney general. There was some discussion of that, and one of the concerns, if you believe the same people who create things in the media, Matt, one of the concerns was that Branch would be perceived by some quarters of the Republican Party as not conservative enough, and that Ted Cruz, the former Solicitor General, was going to be this big challenger from Branch's right, and there was some sense, well, is Branch going to get caught up in this whole thing that you're not sufficiently conservative? You know, very smart for Branch. Branch understands that Branch's base, his power base right now, is his chairmanship of higher ed.
Right.
And, you know, President of the United States comes to the University of Texas to talk about higher education, and you're the chairman. Go. It's pretty smart. Zaffirini there?
I did not see Zaffirini there.
Chair of higher ed on the
Senate side.
On the Senate side, well.
But I agree. I think it was extremely smart for Branch to be there.
Maybe if Obama had talked at 3 in the morning, she would have been there, actually.
You know, it's just in the current climate, it seems like you can't do anything that makes it appear that you like anyone who plays for the other team. It's like you and I talking about baseball. I mean, it's pretty ridiculous, really. I know. Well, let's move on. Sticking kind of to a D.C. topic real quickly, there was a bill passed in the U.S. House yesterday. The president's already signed it. It gives to Texas about $800 million in FMAP money. That's money that's going to help pay down Medicaid cost for the state. It also will give about $800 million to the state's K-12 schools. But Congressman Lloyd Doggett from Austin inserted an amendment that, depending on who you talk to, either, you know, binds the hands of state lawmakers with duct tape and, you know, has them ready to shove them in a river, or merely suggests that they should aim for spending the money in a certain way.
Well, and the idea here is that Doggett's what do we call this? Doggett's version of this is that the state took the stimulus money last time, and rather than add that money to what they were already spending on education, took state funds out of education and right. supplanted them with federal money. So what this basically aims to do, whether it's binding or not, is a, as you say, is a point of argument. But
is
what
that, is that true? Do we need to get Gardner in here to
They took some state money out of education, supplanted it with federal money, and used it to balance the budget. There's about $17 billion of federal stimulus money in the current budget, and actually $5 million of it was in the previous budget. So.
And congressional Democrats say the state should have received $2.5 to $3 billion additional education money, and that additional money never made it to schools.
Now, the state's problem with this because
it was put somewhere else.
Right, right. And the state's problem with it last time was that if you're going to spend money on education and you come in and you spend one-time money, then we're going to be, you know, if we add $2 billion to what we spend this year to education, then next year we're $2 billion behind, or we just had these temporary programs and we had to stop this. So Doggett comes in with this thing this time and says, you can have this money, but you can't use it to supplant state funds. So that's what this fight's
and
about.
And it kind of hinges on, it tries to tie it to the percentage of state spending in the overall budget. And it really, from people I talk to, it looks like it's not a hard goal to meet. I mean, the state has not cut education spending. Even in 2003, when we had a $10 billion hole, education spending was not cut. So it seems as if it's a pretty easy promise to but at the same time, why would Governor Perry promise anything to Lori
Doggett? He's also really tweeting. We typically tweet. Now we're tweaking.
You never know.
He's tweaking the hypocrites who say, I hate the federal government. I hate the federal government. Yeah. We don't want to take anything from the federal government except for the stuff we do want to take. And I mean, the reality is the culture of this state right now is so hostile to Washington. You would think that we wouldn't even allow, you know, the Washington Nationals to play here, right? I mean, it's bad. But there are moments not as publicized as the times we reject the federal government's embrace
when we meet the president on the tarmac and ask him for more troops.
The fact is, if we're going to take the government's money, we shouldn't expect that it has nothing behind it. You know, we take it, we should spend it on the stuff that it's intended to be spent on. And people should be talking about that, and then let people decide up or down whether that's a good idea.
Well, I'm going to try to figure out today, make a few calls, and see, you know, what kind of lawsuits could be coming from state leadership.
Is anybody for this?
Well, school districts. I mean, they're getting the school districts. One of the things that the amendment also did is it changed the way the money, what formula the money flowed through. Instead of flowing through how many students you have in the district, it flows through federal Title I program. That's weighted towards low-income school kids and low-income school districts. So a school district like Houston ISD, which was already going to get, I don't know, 75, 80, 90 million from this bill, gets actually an additional $40 million because it's changing the formula that the money gets sent down to the school district. So school districts, especially poor school districts, think this is great. And you've got school districts not only in Texas but across the country that were laying off teachers or specialists or, you know, cutting back staff because of budget cuts that are coming within their own states, their state legislatures. So the school districts seem to think this is quite fine. And there are education groups that also are like, hey, now we get to retain our reading specialist teachers that were about to be fired.
You know, the teacher unions, teacher groups, they were all for this. So,
but so I was just looking around to see when Elise was going to move on to the next topic. She's not here, though. So let's move on to Bill White's donor appointees. We've heard a lot about the appointees that Governor Perry has in various positions or in all positions around state government. But Matt, you took a little look at what Bill White's supporters, where they also came in.
Right. And I've written about Perry, you know, taking donations for his appointments in the past. But as the White campaign has started to attack Perry for this, I thought, why don't we go back and look at all the money that Bill White has raised during his mayoral tenure, but also in his Senate and gubernatorial races, and then cross-check that with the list of more than 1,000 people he appointed when he was mayor. And what we found is he, too, has taken plenty of money from his own appointees.
I know, shock, shock, shock. Right.
Shocked.
It's a Casablanca moment here.
I guess the opposite of this would be, you know, we only accept money from people we don't appoint. We only appoint people who don't give us money.
In fact, only if you hate me will I take
it. Right.
Well, this was the whole thing with Hutchison, Matt. During the primary, Hutchison was running around saying that Perry was guilty of cronyism and this was a terrible blot on the governor's office. But the reality is, when she got in, assuming she won, what was she going to do? Appoint her enemies? No, she was going to appoint people who supported her.
Somebody loves me, obviously. Their judgment's good, right?
It's longstanding practice for elected officials to appoint people who have been donors. Presidents appoint ambassadors to exotic locales, and Governor Bush certainly appointed regents and others who gave him large amounts of money when he was running. Ann Richards did the same thing. But Perry, because of his tenure in office, has done it more, because he's had to appoint more regents than anybody else. He's had to appoint more people to the Parks and Wildlife Board, for example. And he doesn't have contribution limits. So a lot of these wealthy individuals can give him, you know, $250,000. So these numbers really jump out at you. So White has been attacking him. Even, you know, he's sent out a tweet a few months back about political nature of appointments. He's rolling out an ethics plan right now, talking about, you know, with appointments and contributions, a key part of that. So we've been doing research for the last couple of weeks on, you know, looking at his appointments, and he's raised about $2 million, just under $2 million from his appointments. You know, in fairness, he's raised $30 million overall. So it's a fraction.
And the amount of money he's raised from his appointees, for the reason you said, is actually less than the amount of money the governor has been in office longer and does not have the same limits.
Right. In Houston,
he's raised more.
In Houston, there are limits. You can only give $5,000 a cycle per person, per candidate.
Right.
So it's harder to amass, you know, large amounts from individual appointees.
It's not apples to apples, but it's the same thing.
They've both
taken a lot of money from people that they appointed to office. Now, Perry's in this position. You know, this flips every 6 years. If you're governor for 6 years, you go through the entire cycle of appointments. Perry's about to flip for the second time. I mean, if he goes two more years in office, he'll have flipped it twice. That's a lot of people to appoint. And as you say, it's unlimited stuff. But White's appointed about 1,000, or he appointed about 1,000 people?
It's about 1,200 or so.
Uh-huh. See, I'd be interested to know, you may not know this, but I'd be interested to know, are there instances in which people who were White supporters and were White donors then suddenly became non-White supporters, and as a consequence of that, White dumped them? You know, one of the things that was, I personally think, not sufficiently looked at during the last sort of 9 to 12 months was the key Perry appointees on boards of regents or commissions who decided to support somebody else and then all of a sudden were complaining of pressure to resign from those things.
Right.
So, for instance, Wendy Sitton, the former mayor of Lubbock, who was a Texas Tech University system regent.
Mark Griffin, also a Tech
Mark Griffin, regent. Former state representative candidate, right?
Right.
There have been, you know, and some people believe that Robert Rowling, who is now back in the Perry camp, but who was for a while in the Hutchison camp, that the whole UTEMCO flap that resulted in his resigning as the chair of the UTEMCO board was and he had been an appointee of the governors to the Board of Regents at UT system, that was in fact some tit for tat related back to his support of Hutchison. And I'd be curious to know, if you do know, are there any instances in which it appears that somebody who no longer supported White then suddenly was no longer an appointee?
No, I don't know of an example. I mean, there are plenty of people who donate to White because it was a nonpartisan office who were also supporters of Perry or Hutchison.
Right.
And some of those were appointees. I'm looking at a list here with the late James Elkins on there, who was appointed to the Parks Board by White, but also is a donor to Republicans. And I think Ned Holmes, who's a
port commissioner, right, was a port commissioner.
Was a port commissioner, is now a transportation commissioner for the state of Texas.
And he's
now Perry appointee.
A donor to White, but also a donor to Republicans. And that's just part of the nature of Houston politics.
And in fact, he had been a K donor who, didn't he cross back over? Is he now back to supporting Perry?
You know, they all start to blend together.
But again, though, the issue is this is politics.
Right.
I mean, you know, you can hate it. Hate the sin. Right. Don't hate the sinner.
This is the thing. If you're going to accept money, if you're going to set up a system where people get elected by accepting money from private individuals, and then if they're successful and they get elected, they begin to run their government, they're naturally going to go to business and community leaders to help them run their government. And as it turns out, we've set up a system where the business and community leaders are also the main donors, and so these lines blur very, very, very quickly.
Yeah.
And it gets this thing. You know, it can be unfair. I mean, you sometimes get this thing where it looks like a bad thing, and it might be a completely innocent deal. It makes the innocent look guilty.
Right. And a lot of these folks are, you know, wealthy, civically engaged already. So they're the people who would likely want to spend time volunteering on a board.
Right.
You know.
It just seems to me that it's good to know about where the money's coming from and all, because it seems like when we usually find out about this is when we have a brownie moment. We have an appointee who probably shouldn't have been appointed in the first place, but
I thought you meant brownie like dessert. You meant brownie like FEMA.
Heck of a job, brownie.
Cookie. Yes, right. Yeah, I get it. Okay.
So, to me, it's almost, you know, not who Perry is appointed or who White is appointed, but so where was there an obvious mistake in this appointing?
Well, and of course, by the time we post this podcast, I guess we're posting this podcast around the time that tomorrow morning's appearance before the Tech Association of Broadcasters by both the governor and the mayor will be happening around the same time. So surely, Ross, by tomorrow morning, you will be asking the mayor.
They'll be talking about this.
Are you, by releasing this, you know, sort of statement and policy and criticizing the governor, are you today pledging that if you are elected governor, you will not appoint anybody to any office who has given you a dollar? Is that what you're saying, Mayor? That would be the question, right?
I guess so, yeah. I mean, you know, how do you draw the line? How do you make this?
You can't say yes with a straight face.
Right. It's one of those things where, you know, you have to figure out, and, you know, and let's give them the benefit of the doubt until we hear from them. I mean, you've got to assume that they've figured out where their bright line is, and they've drawn their ethics policy to accommodate their bright line and accommodate their own history in Houston. So, you know, we'll see how it rolls out.
And just one other thing I wanted to add. It wasn't easy to do this. We asked the White campaign a little bit of background. Until 2007, that election cycle in the mayor's race in Houston, all these campaign finance things were filed on paper. So we asked the White campaign, which surely has them digitized because they use them for voting for lists, to provide us the data as they had provided to me when I was a City Hall reporter in Houston. And they declined. So in order for us to do this analysis, we had to spend a lot of money and time, hire a company to key in all these paper records into a database. And you can bet there's a reason why they didn't want to release it electronically. They didn't want someone doing a story like this, probably.
Right.
Well, it just goes to show that, you know, if you don't believe in transparency, we're going to get you. You know, transparency is going to happen regardless of whether you want to make it easy for us.
Well, and, you know, it's especially hard to be... It's especially hard to remain opaque when you have public records here. I mean, you know, all the money that was given to White as mayor, that's a public record, even if it's on paper. I mean, all the appointments that he made, that's a public record, even if it's only on paper.
You can make it hard, but you can't make it impossible.
Right.
Can't make it invisible.
Good stuff.
So we also, one last topic today, residency and the issues of that in Texas. A lot of lawmakers coming out saying maybe you shouldn't have that birthright agreement that we have here in the country.
Suddenly we're talking about the 14th Amendment?
Is that not it? Wait a minute. I read the wrong story.
A Phil Pott moment.
Dang it.
It took 20 minutes.
No, this has to do with where do you live. And if you're running for office in Texas, specifically...
This is so great.
Specifically, you had to have your mom with him, right? Yeah. Brian Birdwell was born in the state of Texas, I will say.
So he's a citizen.
He is a citizen. Since 1961.
He's not an anchor senator.
But for some time, he lived in Virginia, partly when he was serving in the military and partly after he was in the military. And what's at issue here is whether his vote in a Virginia election in November 2006, which is less than 5 years ago, made him a citizen of Virginia. The Texas Constitution requires its state senators to have lived in the state for at least 5 years before they serve. If the Virginia vote made him a resident of Virginia, he's ineligible. So you get into this thing about, well, what's residency in Texas? And it's a hairball. It's a mess. This is going to court this week. The Democrats have sued to knock Birdwell off.
And to do that, they had to have a person of interest, someone that mattered with the race.
So the Democrats, you know, nominated a candidate. 12 hours later, literally 12 hours later, the candidate filed suit. The briefs are due by the end of this week. And because of the way the law works, the court... unless it stretches the deadlines, which it can do, has to decide by the end of next week whether Birdwell's a resident of Texas or not, and whether intent alone constitutes residency, whether you can vote in another state and still be a resident of Texas. It's, you know, it's just not the dictionary definition of residency that you would expect.
Why do the Democrats – help me understand this. If I get this, the Democrats don't win the seat if they knock Birdwell – off the ballot. The Republicans get to put somebody else in there.
It's a timing issue. If the courts were to disqualify Birdwell, and if they were to disqualify him before August 20th, the Republican Party would have the legal right to replace him on the ballot. If the courts were to knock him off the ballot after August 24th, they wouldn't have the right, unless the courts, in knocking him off, also said you can name another candidate. But you're right. I mean, this is a Republican district. This is, you know, John Culler is the Democrat here. He's the former McLennan County Democratic Party chairman. He's a former member of the state Democratic Executive Committee. This district's red. And if you have a Republican and a Democrat on the ballot, you know,
the point is that, I know that Birdwell won the special.
Right.
But let's say they knock Birdwell off.
Right.
Okay. Who's going to be the nominee? Sibley.
Yeah.
Well, he just is. I mean, I'll say it right now. He just is going to be the nominee.
This is the former state senator and the loser of the special election.
Who is more likely to beat the Democrat in the fall?
I think anybody with a red jersey beats anybody with a blue jersey.
Right. But
unless there's some other factor.
If there are questions about Birdwell that are raised as, a legitimate result of some of this, Democrats would rather run against a guy. Maybe people are walking in and voting with him going, I want to vote for the guy, but I'm concerned that maybe he's not.
The play here. If by going to court they raise this issue, they raise the profile of this issue, and they lose, the Democrats campaign on this issue for 60 days against Birdwell.
So it's bad news we didn't knock Birdwell off the ballot. Worse news we did. And
right.
So I kind of wonder, from the Democrats' perspective, is this necessarily the outcome that they want if they get Birdwell off the ballot?
Not necessarily. Good point.
Is it possible in this day and age for either party to not try to bloody the other side, no matter what the ultimate outcome is?
Oh, you're such an idealist.
I mean, it just seems like...
No.
I mean, here's a chance to punch a Republican in the face. I'll do it, you know?
You're right about that.
Well, and there's some other underlying stuff here. Waco would love to have this Senate seat. Birdwell is from Granbury. Sibley is from Waco. We're walking into a redistricting year, and this district's going to get some squeeze from the West, where people are, where other Senate districts are looking for population. And Waco would like the protection of having a senator based in Waco. So there's that overlay. There's the conservative and moderate Republican overlay. Sibley's a more moderate Republican, some people believe, than Birdwell is. And so, you got that fight within the Republican Party. I mean, there's a million ways to die here.
I come back to what we were told at the very beginning of this whole thing when Averitt stepped away to begin with, that for the Democrats to contest this seat in what is obviously a red district is ultimately bad for Chet Edwards. Because a competitive race for Senate, which brings out more Republicans, ultimately brings out more Republicans to vote for Bill Flores. And there were a lot of Democrats in Waco who would have just preferred that the Democrats took a knee on this race, did not put somebody up against Birdwell or Sibley or anybody else, because all they're doing is stirring up the hornet's nest, and ultimately it's Edwards who may get stung, right?
That's one theory. Now, if you talk to Jim Dunham, who's also from Waco, State House member, or to John Mabry, who's running against a former State House member who's running against Charles Anderson, neither one of them buys that theory. They're both like, bring it, let's have a big fight.
Well, Jim Dunham is a bring it kind of guy.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
Well, before we get into any fights here, we better go ahead and wrap this up today. On behalf of Evan and Ross and Matt and our executive audio engineer, Todd Wiseman, I'm Ben Philpott. Thanks for listening.